B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, May 31st, 2017. Two severe blows to the Fourth Amendment. Reported, one by a leak in Washington, D.C. Imagine that, a leak in Washington. In this case, this is a leak that's actually useful to you and me as American citizens, because it's a leak of a decision from the super secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court based under the FISA law. And the ruling was dated April 26. It's 99 pages long, and it is labeled top secret. But somehow the news site Circa got a hold of it and has released it. And what it shows is that the court rebuked the NSA for a five-year running game of not being honest, or what they call in the polite terms of a court decision, a lack of candor for failing to inform the court of the ongoing abuse of the rules that are supposed to protect American citizens and U.S. persons from unconstitutional surveillance by the National Security Agency. The criticism in this lengthy ruling lays bare some of the frictions between the foreign court, the FISA court, and the U.S. intelligence agencies, and the issues that are exposed give us a window on how the secret federal court oversees surveillance activities and seeks to curtail those that it deems to overstep legal authority. Now, I commend the Miami Herald. It's the only news organ that has seen fit to publish this so far, and I think it's important to know about. And first and foremost, I deplore the fact that we have a secret court that issues secret rulings. It is flatly un-American in my view, and it really doesn't provide security or protection as the pretense would indicate. So the NSA Inspector General tallied up the number of prohibited searches that were conducted in 1 3-month period in 2015, but that information has been redacted. So we know that there is a number. We know that the court was alarmed by the number, but we're not allowed to know what that number is. And this is such a silly game. It truly is. Now, one thing that I learned from this is the difference between upstream and downstream collection. Upstream collection, that is the illegal collection of your communications, that occurs when data is captured as it moves through massive data highways, the internet network, within the United States. Downstream collection occurs as data move outside the country along fiber optic cables, and satellite links. The prohibited searches the court mentioned involved NSA queries into the upstream databanks, which constitute a fraction of the NSA captures around the globe, but are more likely to contain the emails and phone calls of people in the United States. While communications of U.S. citizens or residents may get sucked up in these sweeps, they are considered incidental. They must be minimized. But based on the information that is coming out of this ruling, we know that the NSA and, in turn, the FBI ignored the rules for 5 years. Now, what's going to happen? Not a goddamn thing. That's right. We know that our rights were violated, but nothing will happen. The NSA says, oh, we've changed our practices, and the FBI says that, April of 2016, we discontinued allowing contractors access to raw intercepted data. I'm not satisfied, and you can tell. In an 8-vote unanimous decision that did not include the newest Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, because he didn't hear the oral arguments in the case, all 8 justices struck down a prior decision and a concept called provocation doctrine that had stood for years as advanced by judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. And the decision expands the opportunities for police to abuse your rights by barging in without a warrant, without announcing that they're cops, and other provisions of the Fourth Amendment that I consider to be my contract with this government. Because the Fourth Amendment is not ambiguous. It says that no search or seizure can take place without probable cause and a court order. And consider the facts here before the court in Mendez versus L.A. County. A couple who lived in a shack in a friend's backyard were subject to a raid by the L.A. County Sheriff's deputies because they got a tip that a fugitive parolee was seen in that vicinity. The deputies entered the shack where the couple was napping at the time without a warrant, without identifying themselves as police. So Mendez woke up, and what was his reaction? Bad people have infiltrated my shack, and I'm going to protect my sleeping pregnant girlfriend. So he reached for a BB gun that he kept by his bed. And at that point, the deputies opened fire. Both members of the couple survived, but Mendez had to have his right leg amputated as a result of this raid. Now, the police entered without a warrant. They didn't knock, they didn't announce themselves, and they used excessive force. That was the claim before the court. But writing for the, there was no minority, writing for the majority, the unanimous group, Justice Alito said that this rule provided a novel and unsupported path to liability in cases in which the use of force was reasonable. Now, this is a severe incursion into our Fourth Amendment rights, and it enhances the power that police agencies have. I cannot comprehend why the so-called liberal Democratic members of the Supreme Court went along with this one. The latest leak from the Trump White House, which is not about Trump Russia, is that the president is expected to announce as soon as before the end of the day some modification of the U.S. support for the Paris Climate Change Accord. Now, what's ironic here is that Rexxon Tillerson, who plays Secretary of State in the Trump reality show, he's the former CEO of ExxonMobil. He and Ivanka, the president's daughter, are purported to be the only voices in the administration calling for staying in the Paris Agreement. Now, I can't explain how Tillerson arrives at that, but I'm happy to have his support on this. And this is such a political decision. There are 195 nations currently supporting this agreement. It has goals. It doesn't have hard requirements. And it is pure politics for domestic consumption by the pro-energy, anti-climate change nudniks that leads Trump in this direction. And Michael Oppenheimer, a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and a professor at Princeton, said the actions of the U.S. are bound to have a ripple effect in other emerging economies that are just getting serious about climate change, like India, the Philippines, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And we're told that Steve Bannon is the driver of this purported or leaked news of the policy change by Trump. This, of course, was the center of discussion at the various meetings, the G7 and the NATO meetings in Europe last week. And it's clear that Trump isn't listening to smart international voices, just the nationalist voice of Steve Bannon. So Vice News outlines some of the possibilities here. Trump could announce that he's pulling the U.S. out of the deal, which would trigger a 3-year withdrawal process, and the U.S. could change its mind during that time. He could declare the Paris deal a treaty and then require a 2-thirds vote of the Senate to approve it. And Senate Republicans could then block it. The third and most radical option would be a withdrawal from the deal that underpins the Paris Agreement, the 92 United Nations framework from Kyoto. And so those appear to be the options that are under consideration. and we'll see what is the final decision. Now, what is really ironic here is I mentioned Rexxon Tillerson, okay? Former CEO of ExxonMobil. And today, ExxonMobil held its annual meeting, and there was an institutional shareholder revolt on one issue that was before the body. Investors with 62.3% of the shares voted against the wishes of ExxonMobil management, and they embraced a measure that instructs the giant oil company to report on the impact of global measures designed to keep climate change to 2 degrees centigrade. Now, the institutional investors include BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. And you might think, wow, corporate America gets it. Climate change is a real serious threat. But beneath the language here, I see just fundamental greed. The people who hold Exxon stock are concerned that efforts to control global warming will destroy the market for petroleum products. That's my opinion. That's not based on what they said at the annual meeting. But I believe that's what is really motivating this. Still, it is quite remarkable when investors, particularly the institutional ones, gang up and vote against management at an annual meeting. I have no reports of actual new leaks in the Trump-Russia investigation or scandal today, but Mike Flynn at the center of the storm there, the former National Security Advisor, has relented and agreed to provide some business and personal documents to the Senate Intelligence Committee for their investigation. He said that he will turn them over in the next week or so. He had previously invoked his Fifth Amendment rights, but I'm not really clear on why they have decided that these documents wouldn't violate that protection. There's also the curious case of Carter Page, who was scheduled to testify before committees on the Hill, and he has described himself as eager to testify. He wants to clear his name. And we're told that the testimony of Carter Page has been postponed. Now, the news is coming from Page himself, so we don't have the rationale from the investigative committees. But Trump has jumped on it with a tweet. So now it is reported that the Democrats who have excoriated Carter Page about Russia don't want him to testify. He blows away their case against him and now wants to clear his name by showing the false or misleading testimony. Now, I don't understand this. Again, the only news we have is coming from Trump and Page, and the investigations in both the House and Senate are controlled by Republican chairs. So how is it that this delay or maybe even denial of testimony by Carter Page, how can this possibly be blamed on Democrats? Well, if you can explain it, I'd love to hear about it. Meanwhile, Slate, which is one of those websites that does occasionally produce some really good journalism, also some good writing on non-journalistic topics, it's moved into the zone of BuzzFeed and Vice and the Huffington Post, where there is still some good work there, but a lot of it is bullshit clickbait. And one story that really offended me today is under the byline of Isaac Chotiner. And it is a takedown and a really mischaracterization of the views of a renowned Russia scholar, Stephen Cohen. He's taught at Princeton and NYU. He's the author of several books about Russia and interviewed for Slate. The headline reads, Putin's Defender. The subhead, an American Russia scholar on why he doesn't believe the New York Times, doesn't think the DNC was hacked, and just wants the U.S. and Russia to get along. Now, this is an infuriating takedown of a respected scholar. And he repeatedly responds to the snarky questions. He says, look, Trump is being crippled by these charges for which I can find no facts whatsoever. The interviewer says, I think it would help if he would admit what his own intelligence agencies are telling him, that Russia played some role. Cohen interrupts, no, I don't accept that. I don't accept that at all, not for one minute. He refers to the New York Times and others and says the news accounts are of no value to us. I mean, you and I both know, and then he's interrupted again. No, no value, not on face value. Just because the New York Times says that I don't know Carter Page or Paul Manafort or Flynn did something wrong, I don't accept that. I need to see the evidence. Now, Cohen is holding to a very high standard, one that I aspire to. But in the corporate media, these little, you know, issues about facts and evidence and public testimony instead of anonymous leaks, well, it is a source of derision for people who don't accept it. Point blank question from Slate. Was there a hacking of the DNC? And Cohen says, we do not know that for a fact. He later says, we don't have any forensic evidence that there was a hack. There might have been. If there was a hack, we have no evidence it was the Russians. And we have an alternative explanation that it was actually a leak, that someone inside did a Snowden. Just stuck a thumb drive in and walked out with this stuff. We don't know. And when you don't know, you don't go to war. Well, I support Professor Cohen. And once again, we see the corporate media trying to impose a kind of demagoguery and groupthink, that if you step out of line and you don't buy the consensus position, despite the fact that there is no evidence to support it, that you are some kind of Looney Tunes. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I want to note that Andy in Vancouver has been a longtime subscriber to this podcast at the $10 a month level. He chose to do more than the minimum. And I got a heartfelt note from Andy last week saying, without specifying, that he's fallen on some hard times and he can't afford to continue. And he kind of said goodbye, and I won't be listening anymore. I'm sorry, I got to take care of my problems. Well, Andy, as you know, we have responded by extending to you a Peter B. Collins subscription scholarship. We have awarded Andy a one-year free pass to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and it's subsidized by the generosity of John Zweibel, who's a subscriber from Hawaii, who sent me extra bucks a few months ago for this very purpose. And I don't want to embarrass Andy. I won't mention his last name, and I just feel for him, and I hope that this is a temporary setback. But I want to extend this to anyone else listening. If you're unable to afford a subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast and you want first crack at our in-depth interviews, that's the benefit you get from being a subscriber, just drop me a note, peter@peterbcollins.com. I have never said no to such a request. And I also like to thank Paul Lacombe. He just took out a new monthly subscription. David Levine, Mona Kobus, and Anna Gordonier, they're all loyal subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. You can do it too. Just go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You go to the sign-up page, and from there, you've got options. Find a level that is comfortable for you, and I appreciate your support. While we are distracted by the various scandals and tweets and, oh, Kathy Griffin's ridiculous, headless Trump routine, the wars of choice that were started by the U.S. and that continue to grind on continue to take life. Yesterday, a truck bombing near the Afghan presidential palace killed at least 80 people and wounded as many as 500. It occurred actually on Wednesday, New York time, but I believe it was yesterday, local time. And this is going to be used to try to justify a new surge of American forces into Afghanistan, and we must resist. There is simply no point to putting more American forces into a failed occupation. Likewise, yesterday in Baghdad, there were several bombings, including one that the Islamic State group claimed credit for outside a popular ice cream parlor in central Baghdad, and at least 38 people were killed in multiple incidents. Also yesterday, the U.S. staged another test of missile defense, and I use the term staged advisedly because in the past, most of these tests have been staged so carefully that they have no value in terms of predicting that we could take out a missile that was heading toward the United States or one of our allies. And this, of course, is to brush back North Korea and Kim Jong-un and try to create the illusion that we have the ability to predictably shoot missiles out of the sky. Now, I do agree that occasionally we might be able to score a hit, but these tests have been rigged so carefully in the past, and I don't have enough details on Tuesday's launch, but the interceptor was fired from Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California, and the target ICBM was launched from an island in the Marshall Islands, and we are told that we successfully shot it out of the sky. As I mentioned yesterday and didn't have time to cover this, the Republicans have succeeded in stage one of the repeal of Obamacare. The House vote is a signal that they want to dismantle the signature creation of the Obama administration. And as you know, I don't believe Obamacare is perfect, but the Republicans are intentionally crashing the markets, and they know that they don't have enough votes for any meaningful replacement, and they don't have those votes in the U.S. Senate. And Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has publicly acknowledged this. And this could leave us with a system of health insurance that is being wrecked by Republicans' recklessness, and could leave millions of people uninsured or with significantly higher premiums or with really lousy coverage because they basically can't get to the majority that they need, even suspending the cloture rules. At least three senators in the Republican Party are diametrically opposed to the views of at least another three. And the issue is the expansion of Medicaid, or rolling it back, and about giving states more power to basically write really bad insurance policies and claim that that is coverage for people in that state. And here's a statement, and you tell me if you believe that this is true or not. Orrin Hatch of Utah, chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate: I don't think we want the market to fail. We don't want premiums to be so high that people can't afford them. I think these are weasel words. I think that is exactly what the Republicans are up to. And speaking of health care, the White House is due to release soon a federal rule that would allow many religious employers to stop providing contraception coverage. And I take issue with the phrase that I just read, religious employers. Now, there are Catholic nuns who run hospitals, and I would describe them as religious employers. But the Hobby Lobby Corporation that was at the center of a Supreme Court case that led the court to issue a non-decision and tell the parties to work this out themselves, the Hobby Lobby case brings into sharp focus the idea that corporations cannot have religious values. And yet that is the far-fetched claim that has been advanced by Hobby Lobby, and they've used the Little Sisters of the Poor, the Catholic Order of Nuns, as a really, as a front in the legal battles. And Trump held a Rose Garden signing of this religious freedom executive order that he wrote, and he trotted out the Little Sisters of the Poor for the photo op. And they appear to be willing to be used for this. And, of course, what is so sick about this and twisted is that they claim that it is a burden for the government to mandate that contraception be provided free to anyone who is covered by health insurance. They claim that that is a burden on their right to choose. But they're claiming that they can interfere with the religious practices or religious decision-making of individuals who work for them. And this is just so wrong-headed and so un-American. But Trump is pandering, once again, pure politics to feed the extreme evangelical base that for whatever reason decided to vote this anti-religious individual into office while he pretends to be a man of faith who is committed to protecting people of faith. Trevor Aronson has published part 5 of his Trial and Terror series at The Intercept. I encourage you to read the story of Abdulrahman Farhane, a Moroccan-born U.S. citizen who is going to be released today from a Brooklyn halfway house. He served almost 13 years in prison because he took a guilty plea after a 2-year scheme of FBI informants and provocateurs led to charges against him and a group of others for attempting to send money to jihadists in Afghanistan and Chechnya. And when you read the details, Farhane simply was being polite to a customer at his Islamic bookstore in Brooklyn, and the recorded conversations were used to compromise him so that he felt that he had to take a guilty plea. And the details are more complicated. They were depicted in a powerful documentary called Terror, with the T in parentheses. You may have seen that. And it also soils the reputation of FBI agent, former FBI agent, Ali Soufan, who went undercover to help frame Farhane. He was kind of a good guy in the torturing of Abu Zubaydah, going back to that same era. And Farhane told the judge, "I'm not guilty. I didn't do anything. This is my country. I love my country." But nevertheless, he felt compelled to take the plea deal or face an even longer stretch in federal prison. As you know, last week, the long-shot Democratic effort to take the Montana House seat in its special election, there is only one House seat in Montana, didn't work. And Greg Gianforte, despite beating up a Guardian reporter the night before the election, he won handily. Many people voted by mail, and so the incident with the reporter couldn't have had an impact. But now there is this debate in the Democratic Party. And while I don't think that the singer Rob Quist had much of a chance of winning that Montana seat, I do believe that the Democrats should fully contest every race that they encounter and see how well they can do. But the party leaders are, you know, patting the activists on the head and saying, now, let's not get too far ahead of the game. And I'm linking to two interesting commentaries published in the last couple of days at The Guardian. The first, by Douglas Williams, talks about the failure of the Democratic leadership to learn lessons from the losses last year. And in this essay, Doug Williams uses the example of Florida's party chair of the Democratic Party, Sally Boynton Brown. She said, "This isn't going to be popular, but this is my belief. I believe that we are in a place where it's very hard to get voters excited about issues." She said that people are more responsive to identity messages that connect with emotional beings who can change their lives with the power of democracy. So instead of talking about a $15 minimum wage, the Democrats believe that by saying, "Hey, we're not the Republicans and we're not Trump," that voters will rally to them and put them back in power. And I find this very far-fetched and counterintuitive. But the Democratic leaders who are captive to the corporate cash that fuels their campaigns are willing to water down the demands of the electorate, whether it's Black Lives Matter or those who work and live in poverty despite that. And Williams writes, "It is the Democratic Party continuing to assume that power will simply be given to it by dint of their being not Trump. It's why Nancy Pelosi suddenly cares little about reproductive justice. It's why the poor are being caricatured by party grandees as emotional beings who do not care about the policies that are having such an impact on their lives. It seems they will not learn the lessons of 2016 until they see the Republicans retain their perch in 2018 and even more ghastly in 2020. Another op-ed at The Guardian published today by Stephen W. Thrasher talks about the role of Black voters in the Democratic Party. And he's not very happy about the Dems. He says the contemporary Democratic Party offers little to African Americans other than not being as crudely racist, xenophobic, and misogynist as the Republicans. And he notes that Hillary Clinton got 89% of black American votes overall and a whopping 94% of black women voters. And he doesn't reference the voter suppression that I believe is reflected in the slightly lower turnout of black voters in 2016. Nevertheless, I agree with him on the issues and the ideology of the party and how it fails to connect with black people. For instance, he says the Democrats may whisper about war while the Republicans trumpet about it, yet the bombs falling from drones kill brown people regardless. On these shores, it matters little to black people killed by police whether they're shot with someone named Clinton, Bush, Obama, or Trump in the White House. And in his wrap-up, he says, I have come to think of voting as a form of harm reduction. Voting Democrat is the equivalent of using a clean needle to shoot up, so that trying to get that American high is less likely to screw me up as badly as it could. I've linked to both of the op-eds, and you can read and contemplate them at your leisure. And finally, today, I want to commend Steven Reinhart. He sits on the extreme liberal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. It's not really that liberal anymore. And he was confronting a case where his hands were tied. A Trump administration order to deport a man who entered the country illegally and became a respected businessman in Hawaii was, quote, inhumane and contrary to the values of the country and its legal system, wrote Steven Reinhart. Quote, President Trump has claimed that his immigration policies would target the bad hombres. The government's decision to remove Magana Ortiz shows that even the good hombres are not safe. And Reinhart said Ortiz, who came to the U.S. in 1989, was well-established in Hawaii's coffee farming industry. He paid his taxes, had three U.S. citizen children from whom he will be torn away. And the AP notes, this is an AP story. U.S. immigration arrests have increased 40% in early 2017 from the comparable period last year. But actual deportations are down from late January to late April compared with a year ago. But they're working on it. They will catch up with the sordid record set under the presidency of Barack Obama. 2.5 million people were deported during his reign. Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. It's available every day at all of our outlets, including YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you.